This podcast is brought to you compliments of Kaspersky Lab, protecting more than 300 million systems worldwide against internet threats.
Okay, welcome to the Digital Underground Podcast. My guest today is Matt Green from Johns Hopkins University, who we've talked to before about helps us understand some of the complicated crypto stuff that goes on the interwebs. And Matt was one of the co-authors of a paper that came out yesterday and has been being circulated through the security community. He and his co-authors did some research on an interesting bit of code related to the RSA-NSA mess from back in the fall. And Matt, the paper came out yesterday, and there was a story written by Reuters discussing some of this. And to sort of simplify it to my level, this was sort of related to the dual EC allegations that came out back in the fall, loosely, and you guys decided to take a deeper look at this. Tell me what you guys were looking at and kind of what you found.
Sure. So before I go into it, I just want to just to make sure I give everybody credit. This is actually a joint work by a whole bunch of authors. It's really good work, and I want to just give everybody credit. So the paper was actually written by Steve Checkaway here at Hopkins, Matt Fredrickson, Tom Ristenpark, and another one of his students at University of Wisconsin, Ruben Niedergarten, Tanya Lang, and Dan Bernstein at TU Eindhoven. And they all did really good work. And I'm just speaking for myself here today, but the paper is everybody's contribution. So having said that, let me give you a quick explanation of kind of where we got into this and how this project started. So you may know that back in September, there was a big announcement that the National Security Agency had been essentially tampering with cryptographic standards and products. They actually had a name for it. It was called the Bull Run Project. And what they were doing was they were trying to make commercial encryption kind of broken so that people would be able, the NSA would be able to eavesdrop on people who were using commercial encryption products. And one of the really more disturbing revelations in this was based on Snowden leaks, was that they were actually tampering with standards committees, and they were tampering with NIST standards. NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technologies. Mm-hmm. And one of the specific things that they had tampered with was the standard called Dual ECDRBG, and I know it's a mouthful, but it's a random number generator standard that was published in 2006. And there seems to be a lot of indication in these documents that they had actually put a problem, put a vulnerability into this random number generator. And so it turns out that if you build a system based on this random number generator, it may be broken. And what we learned just a few days later was that RSA Security, for example, had built that random number generator in as the default RNG, random number generator, for their encryption libraries.
Right.
And so we heard that. And then later there were some allegations published in Reuters saying that they'd been paid $10 million by the NSA to do this. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of kind of allegations and stuff on the table. And so when we started looking at this project, or when I became interested in it, my question was, yes, we know there might be a backdoor here. But the specific way that you actually implement the RNG when you build a library that does something like secure TLS, which is the secure encrypted connections that you make when you do web browsing, the specific way that you actually implement the code for that algorithm and everything else could have a big impact on how exploitable that vulnerability actually is. And so we set out to look at a bunch of different products that implemented it to see what decisions they made that might affect that and to compare them and to kind of learn what we could learn maybe by reverse engineering these products.
Okay. And so once you guys sort of dug in there, you started looking at this thing called extended random in Dual EC. What was extended random supposed to do?
So the extended random extension is a really bizarre thing. So we were looking through the code for the RSA BSafe libraries, and they have a couple of free libraries, and we actually reverse engineered them. And while I was actually looking through this code with Steve Checkaway, I found a section that mentioned this thing called extended random. Now, the reason that caught my eye is the way that you break a system that uses dual EC is you get some random bytes out of it, and then using those random bytes, you can predict later random bytes that are going to come out of the system. And since those later random bytes are used to predict key or to generate keys, if you can get them, you can pretty much break the connection.
Okay.
One of the problems we had was we weren't getting enough of those first random bytes to let us break and recover the second random bytes, the ones we needed. It took us a lot of computation to do this. And if we just had more random bytes in the first place, we could do it a lot faster.
Okay.
So when I saw extended random, it was almost like kind of a light going on because, hey, that's exactly what we need. We need extended random. And why would there be this thing in here talking about extending the amount of randomness? That would really help the attack. And when we dug around, we found that there was indeed a standard that was published. And it was published in 2008, actually authored by the National Security Agency, co-authored by the National Security Agency, that specified a way to get more random bytes into TLS connections. And that really helps the dual EC attack, speeds it up a lot, thousands of times.
So why does it help that you have more random bytes? I mean, not being a mathematician or cryptographer, that almost sounds slightly counterintuitive to me.
Yeah, and it's hard to wrap your head around. But the way this works is that if you can get maybe between 30 and 32 bytes from the random number generator using a trapdoor that presumably the NSA might know, you can then predict later bytes that are going to come out of the generator. But TLS doesn't give you 30 or 32 bytes. It gives you 28 usually.
Okay.
And so if you have 28, well, you can still guess the other 2 bytes and get yourself up to 30, but it takes a lot longer. And there are even cases where you can set up dual EC, so you'd actually have to get, you know, the 48 bytes or you'd have to get, you know, 64 bytes. And it doesn't seem like there's any way to attack dual EC when you set it up that way. So it's kind of perverse, but yeah, you need to, the more random bytes you get, the more quickly and accurately you can predict the internal state of the random number generator, which means the quicker you can execute the attack and decrypt TLS connections.
Okay. And the speed at which you can execute that attack, does that depend on, I mean, obviously it depends on a lot of factors like the hardware that you're using and probably a few other factors?
It does. It depends on the hardware you're using. It depends on how you actually implement the attack. And this is where the TU Eindhoven team did a really fantastic job. So this is Dan Bernstein, Tanya Lang, and Ruben Niedergaard. They actually implemented a really, really efficient, optimized attack using a computer that has multiple processors. And so they were able to speed it up a lot. But even using a better implementation and using, you know, very fast hardware, it's not as good as having a protocol that's modified essentially by the NSA potentially to let you get more bytes and thus not as much computation in the first place.
Okay. Is, you know, looking at all of the evidence that you guys saw, is there any legitimate reason? I mean, what would extended random have been used for other than, you know, what you guys use it for essentially?
So that's a good question. So the stated reason for publishing the extended random extension is that the DoD wanted to modify TLS so that these random values that appear in the protocol are twice the security level that they're trying to achieve. So if they want to get 128-bit security, they wanted to have a full 256 bits of nonces. If they wanted to have the equivalent of 256-bit security, they wanted to have 512-bit nonces. However, the extended random extension goes even beyond that. It lets you even put kilobytes of data into the connection and get that information back. So it's a little weird. We all sort of looked at this justification, and we didn't really seem to make a lot of sense to us in the context of making the protocol more secure. It just happens to be that when you're using dual ECDRBG and you're trying to execute an attack, it makes a lot more sense in that context, but we don't know. We can't rule out the fact that there was a good and innocent reason for it.
Okay, so that, I mean, that's possible, but you know, the evidence that you guys found, and you know, being able to execute the attacks, and this kind of helps along those lines. It seems like, you know, having it included in Be Safe and other places, it doesn't look good at this point.
Yeah, and I want to be clear. This is entirely my opinion. I don't want to have any.
Sure.
Is dragged into this. But what we know are three things. We know that this extension was proposed. We know that dual ECDRBG was proposed with possibly a backdoor. And we know that RSA's Be Safe products use both of these things together. And they're the only products that have used really either of those things. And we know the combination of them makes for the possibility of very fast, very practical attacks on systems.
Okay. And, you know, without these kind of backdoors something like Be Safe and a lot of the products that Be Safe is implemented in, even for an organization like the NSA that has, you know, a lot of resources at its disposal and, you know, a lot of brilliant people there, you know, breaking the crypto without these back doors, is that within their reach? I mean, these products have stood the test of time without, you know, without knowing that these back doors were there.
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we don't know what the NSA can do. You know, Edward Snowden has said repeatedly that strong encryption implemented correctly is safe. Now, we don't know if he knows everything that the NSA can do, but it seems reasonable to believe that the NSA can't break all encryption and that the way they've been getting around this is by putting these backdoors into systems. That's their strategy. Maybe they can break some, but not all.
Right. And, you know, you, I think it was, I don't know how long ago it was now, all this stuff is kind of running together, but you wrote an essay a few months ago, sort of speculating on some ways, you know, if the NSA is breaking SSL, here are some of the ways that they could have been doing it. Can you just run through a couple of those? Because I wish I had it right in front of me, but you had some very good points there saying, you know, along the lines of what Bruce Schneier said, you know, trust the math. Cryptography is probably good, but here are some of the ways they may have been able to subvert it.
Right. Well, actually, dual ECDRBG is one of the places where the math actually works against you. It's not that the math is wrong. It's that it appears that the math was designed in such a way that no matter how you implement it, I mean, roughly speaking, if you stick to the standard, there is the possibility that the NSA can break it in anyone's implementation. So there's that. But then once you get past those kind of things, then there's the question of how good is the software. And the problem is that software is where we kind of fall down when we're building cryptographic systems. It's possible to put, well, we saw this very recently. Remember the Apple go-to fail bug?
Oh, yes.
Just recently we saw one extra line in a single file, very easy to miss line, basically made SSL insecure. Now, that required an active attack. It wasn't, you know, it was quite as good as an attack like dual ECDRBG, where if you know the trapdoor, you can just listen and break everybody's TLS connections. But that was a real attack. So, you know, the next way you could do it is by putting vulnerabilities into the code that essentially disable parts of the, you know, the verification of connections or verification of certificates. Then there's also the possibility that you could use bad random number generators of other kinds. There's been speculation that's completely speculation that maybe Intel's RDRAND would be a good place to put a backdoor. But we certainly have no evidence of that, although some people have posted results that say, you know, if you wanted to do it, here's one way you might do it. So again, there are just so many different ways you can break systems if you have well-paid, intelligent people and you give them that mission.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think that's the thing that's, you know, scared a lot of the people in, you know, in your field and in the security community in general is, you know, they, people have always kind of speculated what goes on at Fort Meade with all those, you know, all that money and all those smart people. But now we have some evidence of some of the things that they're capable of doing. And it kind of, I think, leads people to jump, you know, two or three steps ahead and say, well, if they can do that, maybe they can do, you know, that plus this, and you know, that'll look, that's even worse.
I agree, and that's the thing. We I guess maybe some of us were more suspicious than others, but I think that most people believe that the NSA would kind of would not do that. They would stay within their lines and they wouldn't go out and they wouldn't break US encryption products. Now we don't know what they would do, but it certainly seems like that wasn't outside of what their willingness, you know, that was something they thought was in their wheelhouse, so who knows what else they'll do.
Yeah. So is there any more work that you guys are going to be doing along these lines with what you were looking at?
Well, I'm sure others will. For me, this was just something that I really wanted to know the answer to. And I'm glad that, you know, as a team, we were able to answer a lot of these questions. It's not something immediately in our plans, but I think that there's just a lot of work for all cryptographers to do to figure out, first of all, you know, where could these backdoors have been placed? How do we rule them out? How do we build software and cryptographic systems that are less vulnerable to them? And how do we, you know, test them to make sure they're not there? I think that's going to be something we're all working on for a long time.
Yeah, and that whole idea, you know, of ruling out backdoors seems almost impossible.
It's almost impossible, but we're hoping that somewhere between impossible and almost impossible, there's a little room for us to breathe.
Yeah, I hope so too.
And one thing I wanted to say, I forgot to mention, Hovav Shakam and his student Jake Maskowitz, I forgot to mention them in the beginning, and I just wanted to make sure I did that now.
Yeah.
They're up, both authors of this paper.
All right, great.
Great.
Well, I encourage people to go and read the full paper. It's excellent stuff. And Matt, thanks as always for your time. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Compliments of Kaspersky Lab, a world leader in internet threat protection for small, medium, and large enterprises. Visit Kaspersky.com for more information about their line of premium protection solutions.